This episode of Court Junkie is sponsored by Smokeball, a law practice management software company that I know you'll find helpful, especially if you work for a law firm. I know I have a lot of people who are involved in the legal field listening to this podcast, and I think you're really going to like this sponsor. Smokeball is the only case management software that automatically records your time and activity for you, which is why the most profitable small law firms use Smokeball to stay organized, improve productivity, and increase profitability. Get daily digest updates, law firm insights reports, automatic Word to PDF creation, over 14,000 automated legal forms, dedicated account management, and much more. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive 50% off the onboarding fee when you sign up with Smokeball. Just visit smokeball.com/court to get started. That's smokeball.com/court to learn more and to schedule your free demo today.
I told the attorney what I'm telling the people here today. I told the attorney about my experience riding up to the house and when the car being seized. I told the attorney about where I was, that I was away on a business trip. I told my attorney that I was alone and by myself. I told my attorney that my wife was pregnant. I told my attorney that I was having an affair. I told my attorney a lot. And my attorney said, I don't think you should talk to the law enforcement.
Hey, everyone. This is Jillian, and this is part two of my episodes on the Jason Young case. In part one, I went through the state of North Carolina's evidence against Jason Young, who was arrested in December 2009 for the murder of his wife, Michelle Young, back in November 2006. But prosecutors had quite a hurdle to face at trial, and that was Jason's alibi. According to his defense, he was out of town at a hotel nearly 3 hours away when the murder occurred. And sure enough, surveillance video and credit card receipts certainly placed him there. But even with a tight timeline, prosecutors alleged that it wasn't only possible, but that it was probable that Jason was the killer. According to prosecutors, here's what they say happened on that night. Jason left the home he shared with Michelle and their 2-year-old daughter, Cassidy, at about 7:30 p.m. on the night of Thursday, November 2nd. At 7:32 p.m., he stopped at a local gas station. At about 9:30 p.m., he stopped at a Cracker Barrel to eat dinner. At 10:50 p.m., he checked into the Hampton Inn in Hillsville, Virginia. At 10:54 p.m., he swipes his key card to his room for the first and only time. At 11:58 p.m., Jason enters the lobby and picks up a newspaper at the front desk. About a minute later, he is seen on surveillance video, walking down a hallway. Now, it's been said that it would take Jason almost 3 hours to get from that Hampton Inn to his home in Raleigh, so if he did do what the prosecution is claiming, he would have arrived back home at about 3 a.m., maybe a little before, killed Michelle, and then left. At about 5:30 a.m., Gracie Doms, a cashier at the Four Brothers convenience store gas station, testified that Jason came in and got gas. This is about 45 minutes from the Hampton Inn. And sometime after 6 a.m., a Hampton Inn employee testified that someone had moved the surveillance camera to face the ceiling after they had plugged it back in. That same employee had also testified that he had removed the rock from the door that someone had put in there to prop it open. But if it was after 6 a.m., the glass door right next to that door was unlocked, and therefore anyone could enter without a key card. So the prosecution needed to convince a jury that that timeline was doable. In addition to that, they presented evidence that Jason and Michelle had a rocky marriage, that Jason cheated on Michelle, and also presented what seemed like a pretty good amount of circumstantial evidence. Now, Jason had remained silent throughout the investigation into his wife's murder. He didn't speak to investigators or to the media, and he didn't even sit down for a deposition when it came to the custody of his daughter or the wrongful death lawsuit that was filed against him by Michelle's family. But that all changed after the prosecution presented their case, because Jason finally broke his silence under oath on the stand. Today, we're going to go through the defense's case, as well as some other developments in the case that I think you'll find pretty interesting. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 51, Part 2. The first witness up for the defense was Jason's mom, Pat Young. She said Jason was born in 1974, and in 1980, they moved to Brevard, North Carolina. His dad died when Jason was just 5 years old, of Hodgkin's disease. But despite that, Pat said that Jason never had a shortage of father figures around. Uncles, friends' dads, and a man named Gerald, who she eventually married. She said Jason loved all sports, animals, and loved to pester and tease his sisters, of which he had two. She said they would get mad at him, but she used to tell them that he did it because he loved them. She said that even as an adult, Jason teased her. When she had her knees replaced, he would make the sound of a robot whenever she walked because of her bionic knees. She told a story about Jason in ninth grade and how he mooned his grandma, which she said his grandma found delightful. Pat told the jury that she loved Michelle and that she thought they had a very good relationship. She said Jason and Michelle argued some, but that she thought Jason loved her very much. She said they would argue, but then be over it. She said when Michelle got pregnant with Cassidy, they were both excited about it, and that Jason wanted to marry Michelle, that she doesn't believe that he was pressured into marrying her. Pat held up photos and showed them to the jury. One was from Jason and Michelle's wedding. They both look very happy, she said, as she held it up. She showed photo after photo of the couple in what looked like happier times. Pat said that on Thursday night, the night of November 2nd, she talked to Jason, and he mentioned that if it was okay with Michelle, he would stay the night with them on Friday night and then head back home on Saturday morning. He said he had a business meeting about an hour from Brevard. Jason's attorney asked her about the 28 calls Jason made to her that next morning on Friday.
Can you explain that and what was going on with all the telephone calls?
Well, as I've said, my mother was in Bryan Center, so three times a day I would go feed my mother. And it would always take a couple of hours. So when I got back from feeding mother, I saw on my cell phone that I had missed a call and a message had been left. But I think Jason had been trying to get me, or had had difficulty with his phone because the message said, he left a message and he said, I've been trying to call Michelle and I can't, no, he said, I've been trying to get Meredith. He said, I was looking at something on eBay about a Coach pocketbook or something and I left those papers on the computer and I left a message for Meredith, but I haven't heard back from her, so I don't know if she got it. But I told her to go to the house and get those papers and put them away because I want to surprise Michelle with a Coach pocketbook.
Right, there are a series of telephone calls and these telephone records that are for just a few seconds, 13 seconds or 12 seconds, from Jason's cell phone to your home.
To my home or my cell number?
Well, some of them are to your home, and then later they're to your cell.
Okay.
Were you guys getting cut off? What was going on there?
Well, I couldn't take the cell phone into the Bryan Center. You were not supposed to have the cell phone on the Bryan Center. I don't know if I had taken it with me. I don't know. And Gerald was probably on the house. He did tell me that he was having difficulty with the phone, that he was having trouble getting through. All right. So I'm assuming that that's what it was, because we didn't talk 28 times or however many you said.
She said Linda Fisher called her around 2 p.m. and was crying, saying that her Michelle was dead. She said she didn't know what had happened, but that Meredith had told her that there was blood everywhere. She said Linda said that she had been trying to get in touch with Jason. She asked her if she would call Jason, but Pat and Gerald decided not to tell him what happened until he got to their house. She described giving Jason the news that Michelle was dead.
Gerald and I stepped out of the house and he pulled up in the driveway. I think there was another car in between here and he pulled into the driveway. We stepped out and he got out of the car and reached in and got his jacket, and I know he had it kind of over his shoulder this way. And as he stepped around in front of the car, Gypsy, our Australian Shepherd, came. She loved Jason. She came running up, and he bent down and was petting Gypsy. And we walked closer, and as we did, he said, "What's wrong, Mom?" And then I didn't mean for it to just be blurted out, but I still wasn't sure how to tell him anything. But Gerald said, "Jason, Michelle is dead." And Jason just went pale, just went white, and just went down to the ground, you know, just sank down to the ground. And Gerald was on one side and I was on the other. And he said, "That, you know, that can't be right. That can't be right." And he was, he was just, yes, he started crying, and he was asking, "What about Cassidy?" And Gerald and I got him inside, just inside the door. We have a long bench there in front of the window, and we got him sat down on the window. On the bench, I was afraid he was going into shock because he was going hot to cold, hot to cold. So I got a washcloth and a damp washcloth to put to his face, and he sat there for a few minutes, and he just couldn't believe it, you know, and was just sobbing. We got him on in to where the recliner was, and he sat down in the recliner, and I got I had a blanket there. I had tissues. I tried to get him to drink or eat something, you know, get something, because I thought he's going to go into shock. I've got to do something. But and then about, probably 3:15 or so.
At that time, it was just you and Gerald there.
Gerald and me.
All right.
And about 3:15, he made a phone call to Meredith, and she was telling him, I assume that she was telling him, because I heard him say, "Homicide, no, no, no." And at this time, my friend Bev and her daughter came in, and then just a few minutes later, my friend Jimmy Arnett came in. And so, and Jason was just having difficulty talking. He was just sobbing, and I heard him tell Bev, you know, "Not only lost my wife, but I've lost my son."
She said Jason's sister and husband came over, and they decided to get in Jason's vehicle and drive to Raleigh. They received numerous calls while on their drive, and Pat said that she was surprised when a detective called and told her that Jason, quote, "better be with them." She said they had all been so sad and were surprised that the detective would say that. At some point, when they were close to Meredith's house, they got a call from Jason's friend Ryan, who said they shouldn't go to Meredith's house until Jason got a lawyer. So they stopped at an Applebee's and tried contacting attorneys. Ryan then called again and said that they would work on getting an attorney for him, but to go to Meredith so Jason could at least be with Cassidy. He told them not to talk to the police, so they continued on. When they got to Meredith's, Pat said Jason immediately asked Meredith about Cassidy and then went to the bedroom where she was asleep on the bed. She said when detectives called, Jason told them that he would talk to them when his attorney was present. He then handed the phone over to her and told her that they weren't listening to him. So she said she repeated to the detective that Jason would talk to them when he had an attorney and to have a good evening. She then hung up the phone on the detective. She said she and her daughter and son-in-law went to the sheriff's department around midnight. Jason was still at Meredith's house with Cassidy. She said she answered all their questions. After the murder, Jason and Cassidy lived with his sister Heather and her husband at first, but then went to live with Pat and her husband. She said he never went back to the home he shared with Michelle. Pat then addressed the custody of Cassidy issue. She said that during the first year after Michelle's murder, Linda and Meredith Fisher were allowed to see Cassidy, and they did. But then Pat said that she decided to prevent them from seeing her because the last time they were with her, Linda became hysterical and was crying. She and Jason didn't think that Cassidy should be exposed to all the crying and such. They wanted a normal life for her. She said news articles started coming out alleging that Jason wasn't letting the Fishers see Cassidy and that it wasn't true. She was there when Jason was arrested in December 2009.
Jason's vehicle was not running properly, so we took it to a little repair shop on the Rosman Highway, and we went in to tell the attendant what needed to be done, and we gave him the keys and all that, and we came back out, and I had my vehicle there too because I had followed him over, and I said, Jason, I handed him the keys and said, do you want to drive? Because if we were driving together, I preferred that he drive rather than me. And he said, yes, and he walked around to the side of the car, and I had no idea police officers were anywhere. And suddenly he was surrounded, and they cuffed him immediately and walked him up to a car. And I spoke to a couple of the officers, and then I said, can I hug him? Can I tell him goodbye? Can I hug him? And we opened the door, and he had his cuffs back here. And so I reached down to hug him, and then later, Jason wrote to me, and he said, okay.
Is that the last time you ever hugged him?
That was the last time I ever hugged him.
He's been in jail ever since.
Yes, he has, and it has been.
Just answer my questions, okay?
Yes.
Pat was asked if she had heard Michelle Money's testimony, and she said yes. She said she didn't know about Michelle Money or the incident with Carol Ann. I do not approve, she said. She said Jason was raised better than that and that she was disappointed. A few of Jason's friends also testified. One of them, Josh Dalton, recalled how he and his wife knew right away that detectives were focusing in on Jason based on the questions they were asking. Afterwards, several of their friends got together and formed a support group. They decided to tell Jason that he needed an attorney before he talked to the police. On cross-examination, Josh said that most of the people in their group of friends felt like Jason and Michelle would never have gotten married had she not gotten pregnant with Cassidy. When asked about Jason's affair with Michelle Money, Josh said he knew about it from Jason.
What did Mr. Young tell you about his relationship with Michelle Money at that second Thursday night football game?
He basically told me that he thought he was in love with her.
What else?
And they had joked that wouldn't it be funny because she was trying to get pregnant again if it was his kid.
We'll get into more testimony and hear from Jason himself right after this quick break from today's sponsors. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City, and Virginia Beach, or over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Now you can get $125 off and a free pillow when you go to leesa.com/junkie. Let's be real. Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible, not to mention figuring out how much it will cost you or what your results mean. But now it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of tests, from food sensitivity, which measures your sensitivity to 96 different foods that may be causing discomfort, to metabolism, to an at-home STD test. Yep, you can test for STDs all from the comfort of your home. Each test is physician-reviewed, private, simple, and processed through a certified lab. All you have to do is head to everlywell.com, choose your tests, and they'll be shipped directly to your doorstep. Once you collect your sample and send it back to Everlywell's certified lab partner, you'll get your doctor-reviewed, easy-to-read results online in days. Everlywell really is so convenient. No more sitting in waiting rooms, no more mystery bill, and no more waiting on your results. Head on over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. That's everlywell.com, promo code JUNKIE, for 15% off your first order. Take control of your health today with Everlywell's at-home health tests. Your test, on your time, and on your terms. A newspaper carrier named Terry Tiller testified that on the morning of November 3rd, she remembers delivering the newspaper in Jason and Michelle's neighborhood. When she was on Birchleaf Drive, Jason and Michelle's street, she noticed that the Youngs' house was lit up.
That morning, the only thing that I noticed was when I went in to deliver and went down the street, Birchleaf, the Youngs' house was lit up. It was brighter than ever. It had interior lights, exterior lights. They'd have pillar lights on their driveway, pillars. Everything was lit up. So I thought that was, I mean, that jumped out at me because normally it was dark. And I immediately thought, well, maybe they had a family get together or a party or something because the house was all lit up and parking looked different. There was, you know, cars not in like the driveway.
Okay. About what time would you say this was that you saw this?
It was probably, I would say, well, I'd pick my papers up between 2:30 and 3, so that would put me getting there between 3:30 and 4, depending upon, you know, how long it took me to get my stuff together and get moving.
Okay, just so we're clear, we're talking 3:30 or 4 a.m.
In the morning, yes, in the morning, okay. Which is another reason the house jumped out at me with the lights being on because it was 3:30 or 4 in the morning.
Okay. What? Why did it, I mean, obviously the lights, had you been by before and the lights had been on or?
No.
Okay. How long had you worked as a delivery person by this time?
I had been delivering papers there, or the New York Times, since October of 2002.
Okay. Did you ever recall a time when you saw it lit up, saw that house lit up like that?
No.
Okay. Tell the jury what else you saw, if you recall.
Well, one thing that I noticed was the parking, like I said, looked like maybe they'd had a party or something because, you know, there was a car in the yard, not in the yard, but in front of the house. And it looked like it was parked parallel, and it was a light-colored SUV. And if I'm not mistaken, there was a minivan also on the street, on the far side of the street.
Okay.
Don't know if it actually went with that house or not, but that's why I thought there could have been a party or something, because cars weren't parked, like, in the driveway, per se.
Okay. When you said you saw a minivan, you remember what color?
It was kind of like, I would say a blue, silver green, okay. Not black, but, you know,
okay.
Blue.
Let's talk for a minute about the car in front of the house. Can you describe for the jury, to the best of your memory, what you saw?
It was an SUV-type vehicle. It was a light in color. That could be silver, white, yellow, just a light in color. SUV type vehicle. That's all I know as far as that one's concerned.
What type, size, if you remember?
I would say medium.
Okay. Okay.
It wasn't like an Expedition, but it wasn't like a smaller one.
Okay. How was it situated?
I believe it was parked parallel to the house, in front of the house.
Okay. When you say that, do you mean in the yard or on the street or?
Well, I'm a little confused about that, I must admit, because originally I had said in the yard, but then as time went on, I'm not clear if it was actually in the yard or on the street in front of the house, but it was parallel with the home.
She made her deliveries, and when she was done, she noticed that the Youngs' house was still lit up. She reported what she saw to police the next night. Cindy Beaver, one of Michelle's and Jason's neighbors, who also lived in the Enchanted Oak subdivision, said that on Friday, November 3rd, she left for work at about 5:30 a.m. When she was leaving, she noticed lights inside the Youngs' house, as well as the porch light and lights at the end of the driveway. Typically, she said it was dark. She saw a vehicle coming out of the driveway. She said she had her bright lights on so that she could be on the lookout for deer, and her lights shined on the car. She described what she saw.
There were two people in the car, and since the car was coming out of the driveway, you know, my lights hit them first, right in the face, Okay. Basically.
Okay. What type of vehicle was it? Can you tell the jury?
I'm not good with cars. It was bigger than a station wagon. It was what I phrased it like a soccer mom type car. It was, big, elongated. Wasn't a sedan or anything, but that type of vehicle.
All right. Now, you said a few minutes ago you noticed two people in it.
Uh-huh. There was a driver and a passenger.
Okay. What, if anything special, did you notice about either one of those individuals?
Well, like I said, when my lights hit the front of their car, it hit the passenger's face first. But immediately, that person, like, jerked to the side really quick. And that's what made me think, oh, my gosh. I was embarrassed because the bright lights had hit this person in the face, and their face turned away from me toward the driver. And so I was, thinking about that as I actually went by them. Secondly, my next thought was, are they paying attention? Or this early in the morning, normally people aren't out there. And are they even looking to see that I'm coming, or are they going to scoot on out in front of me?
Okay. So, now, what time was this, if you remember?
It's around the 5:30 mark.
Okay.
Could have been a few minutes before, not much after. I purposely, very sheepishly, looked over to the folks in the driveway because I didn't know whether to wave sorry or what their reaction would be to the fact I had just blinded them with my lights. And the passenger's head was still turned, like, toward the driver as if they were talking, and I'm assuming maybe they're talking about me not being very courteous. And so I looked, and then I did look at the driver, and I remember hands on the steering wheel. And I knew from that, the lights from the dashboard thing was lighting up the steering wheel where he was gripping it. And I saw that it was a white man, Caucasian man. The passenger, I assumed, was a woman because the thickness and the bushy hair. I can't swear to that for certain. I just assumed that it might have been a couple or something.
She said she also saw a delivery-type van, all lit up on the inside on the next street, about to turn on to Birchleaf. She saw that there were newspapers in the van. On cross-examination, she was asked if she had told agents in one interview that she wasn't positive about the exact date. She said that in January of 2008, she was interviewed again about what she saw, this time by a new agent who was more persistent and who kept asking her, "Are you certain? Isn't it possible that it was another Friday? Isn't it possible?" She said she finally told him, "Well, I guess anything is possible." And then, after years of not speaking, Jason himself finally took the stand.
State your name, please.
Jason Young.
Jason, did you love your wife, Michelle?
Yes, sir, I did.
Were you a proper husband to her?
No, sir, I was not.
Do you love Cassidy?
Absolutely.
Are you a good father to her?
Yes, sir, I am.
Did you kill your wife, Michelle?
No, sir.
Were you there when it happened?
No, sir.
Do you know who did it?
No, sir, I do not.
Jason started by telling the jury how he and Michelle had met when he was about 26 or 27 years old and had already graduated from NC State. He met her at a bar in downtown Raleigh and then saw her again when their group of friends went to the movies. He said he was overwhelmed by her at first and felt like she was a little out of his league. They fell in love, and he said he was surprised when she got pregnant, but that it was a good surprise. He was asked if her getting pregnant caused them to get married, and he said no, but it did expedite it. Michelle gave birth to Cassidy, and they bought the house on Birchleaf Drive. He was asked if he and Michelle felt safe in that house.
Yes, I did feel safe in that house.
Did Michelle?
All I have ever heard from her was that she felt safe in the house. The one thing, at the first fall after we bought the house in, we'd moved in around July is actually when we moved in. And when the leaves and stuff started falling down, you could kind of see a trailer park back in the back distance, and you could see that when the leaves were down. And I think that was something, it was more aesthetic. She didn't like the looks of it. It was more like that.
Okay. Did she ever call you one time and say anything about hearing a strange noise?
This was later on. She did call, and she said something about hearing a noise. And I said,
where were you?
I thought about that. I was on the road, and I don't know if I was in Colorado or I don't know.
Well, that's my point. You weren't in Raleigh. You were out of town, out of state somewhere, right?
Yes, I was in a hotel room, and it was late at night, and I remember saying to her, hang up the phone, call the police. Don't call 911. You don't put me in that situation. There's nothing that I can do from where I am. And she stayed on the phone, and I knew Michelle can be kind of dramatic, and she could do things like that. And she was like, oh, I don't think it's anything. G didn't do anything. G's still here. And I talked with her a few more minutes, and was the end of that.
Jason was then asked about their dog, Mr. Garrison, or Mr. G.
You bring it, Mr. G. Was he an inside dog or an outside dog?
He was usually an inside dog. There were days.
Where did he sleep?
He slept in our bedroom on the right, actually next to me. His dog bed was on the floor right next to mine.
And what was the ordinary nightly routine as far as Mr. G goes?
Mr. G is a different kind of dog. He like has his own bedtime, and he's the type, you can let him out at maybe 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and he'll come back in, and there can be action going on downstairs or whatever. And, you know, most dogs would stay around people, but when it's time for him to go to bed, he goes up the stairs himself, goes to his bed, and lays down. He's kind of like a little person.
Okay. Did he have the run of the house?
Yes.
There weren't any dog gates on the stairs or
no, sir.
Anywhere?
No, sir.
Jason was then asked to describe Michelle's ordinary bedtime routine. He said she would put Cassidy down, watch something on TV, sometimes work out, but would typically work out and then shower, not just go right to bed. She would sometimes work at night, he said. It just varied. He said he saw photos of how she was dressed when she was found, and he said that she would never wear anything to bed with a zipper on it. Jason said their next pregnancy was planned, and he was excited when she became pregnant again. She had a miscarriage, and they made plans to have another one. When she got pregnant again, he was ecstatic. They found out they were having a boy, and they were thrilled. A boy and a girl. It was perfect, he said. He told the court that they had issues in their marriage, but that he was willing to work on them. He wanted to stay married to her and to have more kids. He said he never seriously thought about divorce. When it was mentioned, it was more of a heat of the moment, not serious kind of thing, and neither of them ever went to a lawyer or anything. His attorney brought up the testimony from the women who testified.
Now, Jason, there's been testimony from some women in this case. I want to start with Genevieve Carville. She is the young lady who described the ring incident where she said you took the ring off her finger. Did you do that?
Yes, sir, I did.
Did you throw her around on the bed like she said?
No, sir. What I did was wrong. I did pin her down, and I took the ring.
Okay. What was your level of intoxication at that time?
I was very intoxicated, but I don't feel like that's an excuse for what I did.
Okay. About how old were you at that time? Since that incident, have you ever put your hands on a woman in anger?
No, sir. And before that incident...
Did you learn anything from that? From that incident?
Yes, sir. I have...
What?
It's completely wrong to physically do anything to anyone like that when you're angry with someone just because you're bigger than them or stronger than them. It's wrong.
And what did that cost you?
It cost me that entire relationship. It ultimately led to the end of that relationship.
Did she break up with you?
Yes, sir.
You saw Carol Ann Sowerby testify about a time when you two had sexual relations in your marital home. Did that happen?
Yes, sir.
Did it happen the way she described it?
Yes, sir.
All right. She also described an incident where you put her wedding ring in your mouth. Did
yes,
you do that?
I did.
Did you actually swallow the ring?
No, sir.
What was that all about? What did you do?
That was a... It was a joke. It was a joke that I played on Carol Ann, and it was a joke that Michelle was there and saw and was witness to. And I believe when I did it, it's just me being silly. There was nothing behind it. It wasn't thought out. It was more spontaneous. I put it in my mouth and I made him think that it was swallowed. And I remember Carol Ann was upset, but still thinking, are you serious? Like not really believing it? And then Michelle was upset as well. I think she was more upset thinking, you're gonna damage this wedding ring and it's gonna cost us a small fortune. This was very late at night. We go to bed soon thereafter and I had just put it back on my cheek. And when I went to the bedroom, Michelle was still upset with me. And when I showed it to her, she laughed and was in on the joke, and when you included her and put her in on the joke, she actually thought it was funny, and I said, I'm just gonna give it back to her in the morning. And so...
She went along with that?
She did go along with that. She actually thought, once she saw that we weren't gonna have to pay for damages for a ring or anything like that or risk losing it, she thought it was funny and she went along with it. And she, in fact, told people about it later that she didn't even have to tell about, almost like, listen to what Crazy Jason did, knowing that I didn't do it, but that was, and I've kind of been known as the crazy guy. I kind of like that role. I've always been that person, so.
You've been described as the life of the party. You think that's fair?
I would probably like to be, and at times I probably was.
Okay. There's also been some testimony from Michelle Money. Did you have a relationship with her?
Yes, sir, I did.
Was she telling the truth when she testified?
Yes, sir, she was.
Did you have any designs in your own mind of leaving Michelle Young for Michelle Money?
No, sir.
He said that he and Michelle Money confided in each other a lot, and they felt that the intimacy in their marriages was missing. It led to an intimate relationship between the two of them, but he knows for a fact that they each loved their families and that they both knew that it was wrong. He said he doesn't think either one of them ever dreamed that it would have been found out. He then talked about the weekend of November 2nd. He said he decided to stay over in the hotel on Thursday so he could break up the travel. He had a meeting scheduled for 10 a.m. on Friday morning. Before he left, he said he looked at anniversary presents from Michelle.
I received a lot of grief and been in kind of an argument with Michelle, and I heard from her mom, and I wanted to make up for what was perceived as a pretty lousy anniversary and a pretty lousy anniversary gift. So I wanted to surprise Michelle with something that is non-typical for me, and that would be to spend a lot of money on a little item just because of the name. And it was a leather coach purse.
And how'd you get the idea for a leather coach purse?
Meredith had mentioned that she likes, I know, like she testified, Linda or Michelle and Meredith would go to New York and go to like the back corner alley where they could get the knockoffs for really cheap, but to get a real one would mean a lot. So it was an idea that had been planted there, and I think it was something that...
Did somebody suggest to you that you could go on eBay and sort of look at them?
Yes, Michelle Money had told me that was something that you could do. I don't think I'd ever purchased anything on eBay. I wasn't extremely familiar with it, but I'd heard of it, of course.
So on the early evening of November the 2nd, were you upstairs on your computer looking at purses?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Right. And those eBay searches that have been testified to and put into evidence, did you do those?
Yes, sir.
There's been some testimony about the fact that these auctions were about to expire. What's the significance of that in your mind?
Well, the ones that I looked at, if you want to get an idea of what the cost is, you kind of, the ones that were about to expire, you kind of see ballpark what those prices are and find out a little more about that bag and what you're getting with that. I was kind of just trying to price and get an idea of what I was getting into and how much I was going to be spending.
So when you got on eBay that night, was it your intention to actually bid on anything?
No. I was actually had been even told from Meredith, I think, before you get anything, let me look at what you're, you know, I just wanted to get some ideas of cost-wise, what I was looking at, and style-wise, some things like that.
Okay, and did you print some examples off?
I printed the pages that I was looking at.
What did you do with them?
I left them on the printer.
Was that your intention at that time?
No, sir.
What did you mean to do with them?
I meant to put them in the bag so I could have with me.
He said he absolutely wanted the purse to be a surprise. Michelle loved surprises, he said. He didn't dispute the beginning of the prosecution's timeline. He left his house a little after 7 p.m., went to the local gas station, and then went to eat at Cracker Barrel. He then described what he did after checking in at the hotel. He said he took his bags up to his room and called Michelle at home to tell her that he made it safely and to say goodnight. He said that was the last time he spoke with her. Afterwards, he talked to Michelle Money, and then, he said, he did leave his room.
One thing I wanted to do was, since it was kind of nervous about the sales call the next day, I wanted to be able to review the software on my computer, and I had not remembered my plug-in. When I got everything out, I didn't remember the plug-in. I'd left it in the car.
You mean the charger?
The charger, I'm sorry. Yes, sir. And so I left the room, and I remember when I left the room, all hotels that I've ever stayed in, the doors are pretty heavy and they have got a pretty good pulling mechanism, and they slam usually. And I know I try to be cognizant of neighbors because I've been woken up before plenty of times. So when the door, I just remember when I left, keeping the door or pulling the door to, and it didn't have that force or anything with it. In fact, to latch it, you'd have to pull and give it a tug. And so I let it kind of go flush, and it didn't have enough force to even come all the way clicked and make that latch. You'd have to give it a tug. So I just left it as it was. And
it was sort of propped open.
There was nothing propped on it. It didn't close on its own. It wouldn't come all the way to and close. You'd have to physically give it a pull.
Okay. So was it the door latch itself that was sticking out that didn't go into the... I'm trying to understand what was holding the door.
Yes. It didn't even have enough force that the door latch that was there that makes that clicking noise, it didn't even have enough force to click back. So it would just stay abut just like that without even having to click back.
And then where did you go?
So I just went down the hallway. I was going back to where my car was, and my room was on the other end of where my car was. My room ended up being on kind of the pool side. There's no parking over there. I was on the other side. So I walked down the hallway, and I went down the steps, and at the bottom of the steps, I went out the exit door. And the exit door, I realized when I opened that door that there's no way to get back in. That's one of those doors that you can't get back in.
Was that the exit door directly off the stairwell?
Yes.
You walked down the stairs?
Yes.
From the fourth floor?
Yes.
Was that unusual for you?
To
walk down the stairs instead of taking the elevator from the fourth floor?
No, if I'm not toting luggage or children or anything like that, especially after being in the car for 3 hours for long enough, I would much rather take the steps.
Okay. So when you discovered that that door would lock you out, what did you do?
Well, when you open that door up, there's a, I guess a shrub or the shrubbery right around the building was right there. And I remember my car's just not too far away, but I knew that door would lock. So I remember going down, breaking off a piece of the shrubbery, a stick or a branch or piece of shrubbery, and I put it in the door. I went out to the car and I got my charger, came back in that door, and I went back to my room.
When he got back to his room, he said he didn't have to use his key card because the door hadn't latched shut. He said he then went on his laptop and did some preparation for his sales meeting the next day. Afterwards, he described leaving his room again.
I brought a cigar up to smoke. I wanted to smoke a cigar.
Were you allowed to do that in your room?
No.
Okay, so what did you do about smoking the cigar?
The cigar was still in the car and I had to go outside to smoke the cigar. And I also wanted to go, I just watched the end of the football game and I wanted to look at some sports schedules and some standings. And so I wanted to see if I could pick up the USA Today as well.
All right, did you take the same route down as you had the first time?
No, sir, because the first time I was just going to my car, and this time I wanted to go by the front desk. There's a carousel there that usually has USA Today, and if there wasn't there, I was going to ask the front desk person if he had one.
Okay, so which stairwell did you take that time?
The one that was just the closest to my room. I guess it's been referred to as the east stairwell.
Okay, and then where did you go?
I went down the stairwell, and I went to the front desk, and I didn't see any. I think there was a little place for newspapers. There weren't any there, I guess, the guests from that day, because this was Thursdays. I was just trying to get Thursday's USA Today. So I went to the front desk, and I remember because there was an older person that checked me, and this was a different person. And I asked him if he had any papers, and he said he thought there was one in the office. And I said, well, if you're looking, he goes, no, I'm not looking at it. You can certainly have it. And he brought me a paper from the office.
Do you believe, having seen Keith Hicks testify, that that was Keith Hicks?
Yeah, it had been so long, I didn't recognize him. All I remembered was that he was younger, so it makes sense that there was an older guy and a younger guy, but
okay.
I wouldn't have recognized his face unless someone had said he was.
There's been evidence presented that there's a picture of a man at the front counter around midnight with a shirt with a little stripe across the chest.
Is that you? Yes, sir.
Okay. And what were you doing right there?
Getting the newspaper from.
Did you get anything else?
No, sir.
All right. Then there's a picture of somebody walking down the hall toward the west stairwell.
Yes.
Is that you?
Yes, sir.
And I believe Sergeant Spivey testified what he thought you had in your hand. What did you have in your hand?
The paper that I had just gotten from the front desk.
So it wasn't the Atlas?
No, sir.
All right. It looked like you might have had some water in your hand, did you?
Yes. I was going to smoke a cigar and, you know, I would occasionally smoke cigars, and when I do, your mouth gets kind of dry. I'm usually actually having a beer with the cigar, but I wasn't drinking.
Okay, so what did you do then?
Then I went out the same exit door. I went back out the stairwell exit door.
Why did you go out the stairwell exit door?
Well, because that's the one I'd used earlier, and I didn't have, the sign, I didn't have my key card. I didn't bring my key card with me. Like I said, the door, I just let it go flush through and not latch. So I didn't have my key card. And also it was to be able to prop that door open and keep it open. The building itself, it went in there. There was nothing around out the glass door that was right in front. But I remembered the door that I went out earlier. There's the bush and everything's right there. So you can open that door and reach something so that it doesn't lock you out.
Okay, so did you do that?
Yes, sir.
And then what did you do?
I went to the car and got the cigar. I actually think I also got another brochure that was more focused on smaller hospitals to review that, because that's actually The next day it was a smaller hospital. I looked at our general brochure, but there was a smaller one as well. And I smoked the cigar. I had intended to be able to look at, sit there, smoke the cigar, and look at the newspaper, but it was a bit windy, so I ended up not really opening up the newspaper, you know, how wide it all is, and I ended up taking that with me back to the room, but I smoked the cigar, and then I went back to my room.
Did you have a problem getting the cigar lit in the wind?
I did, actually. I had matches, and I know it, as a kid, I guess, we used to be in Boy Scouts, the big thing was to do a one strike, one match fire. And that's the only reason you think about stuff like that. But two matches I used, just they went out in the wind. So I ended up, I only had about probably a third or a half of the matches. I ended up striking one and using it to strike them all. So it made a bigger flame, because a cigar takes a pretty good size.
So you smoked the cigar. Did you go back in the same door that you went out?
Yes, sir.
And did you take the twig out of the door?
Yes, sir. The reason I know is because it was up higher. The pressure from the door, the twig's just keeping it from going flush. So the twig, when you open the door, would fall down.
And then what did you do?
I went back to my room.
He said he again didn't have to use his key card. He said he brushed his teeth and then went to bed. He set his alarm for 6:15 or 6:30. When asked if he was the man that Gracie Doms had seen at the Four Brothers gas station at 5:30 a.m., he said no, that he was sleeping in his hotel room. After he woke up, he ate breakfast in the hotel lobby and then left. He said he got lost on the way to his meeting, making him about 30 minutes late. After the meeting, he said he was packing up his computer and his papers when he realized that he had never grabbed those eBay printouts.
Why was it important to you that somebody get those papers?
Because I wanted it to be a surprise. We had, we'd had a pretty big fight, the one where she said that I threw the remote. And on top of that, I was getting, you have heard testimony about, I kind of got scolded from Linda and some people about not doing enough for the anniversary, and their anniversary meal didn't go right. So I really was wanting to kind of make up for a lot in a big way, and I really wanted it to be a surprise. A surprise to Michelle means so much more than anything.
There's a card in evidence that's got a postmark from Orlando.
Yes, sir.
Did you mail that card from Orlando?
Yes, sir.
Were you visiting Michelle Money at the time?
Yes, sir. That's what I went to Orlando for.
Was that part of the reason you felt so bad about it?
Yes, sir. I was, I held a lot of guilt, have a lot of guilt for that.
He said he held off on calling Meredith right away because he knew she usually sleeps in. When asked to explain the 28 calls to his mom, he said they were dropped phone calls. He was constantly getting coverage and then getting cut off. He called and left Meredith a voicemail, but he wasn't sure it went through, so he called his mom to see if she could get a hold of her. He stopped for gas in a town called Duffield and then started driving towards another hospital near his mom's house so he could drop off his card. He described learning about Michelle's death once he got to his mom's house.
I remember it was a sunny day. I remember having, the window down. And I remember driving in and seeing my mom and Gerald drive or kind of standing in the yard, and they're.
Was that odd?
Well, they were kind of holding each other, and they kind of were walking towards the car. And I had been petting the dog, and I remember getting out of the car and walking towards them. And you can kind of tell. When your mom's upset, and when my stepdad, when he's upset, which you don't really see him like cry that much, you can tell that there's something wrong. And I thought that there's something wrong with my grandma. And I think I said, "Is it me, mommy?" Which is my grandma. And I remember that's when Gerald told me there was Michelle, and he said Michelle is dead.
What did you do?
I broke on the inside. I just broke, and I didn't believe it. It just didn't feel real. It didn't feel like it was happening. I didn't believe it, and I didn't understand it.
He said he remembers crying and sobbing and feeling really hot and then cold. When asked about the purchase of Hush Puppies orbitals on his DSW account in July 2005, he said yes, he did purchase those. He said he wore them for everything, from business to casual, and that he wore them a lot. He said he was not wearing them on November 2nd. When asked what happened to them, he said he wore them so often that they essentially started falling apart, and that he's pretty darn sure that Michelle got rid of them and gave them to Goodwill. He was then asked about the Franklin shoes, the other shoe impression that had been found at the murder scene.
Did you ever buy any shoes at Family Dollar?
No, sir.
Athletic shoes?
No, sir.
Would you buy a $10 pair of athletic shoes?
No, sir. That's actually where I would actually not be cheap is basketball shoes or cleats or something like that.
He said the blue jeans that had been found in the Ford Explorer in his luggage were the jeans he was wearing on November 2nd. He was shown a photo from Cassidy's third birthday from March 29th, 2007. He was asked to describe the shirt he was wearing in the photo. He told the jury that it was a dark pullover sweater with a stripe across the shirt. And just as a reminder to my listeners, that is the same description of the shirt that Sergeant Spivey said that he was wearing in the last image of him from the surveillance video at the Hampton Inn. The shirt Spivey said they had been unable to find. Jason then became emotional on the stand as he talked about Michelle's funeral. He said he had picked out daisies for her casket, and at the funeral, he did something private between him and her.
I had Michelle and I, when we first were exchanging, like, I love yous and stuff like that, I was telling you about not being able to really dance or not feel comfortable singing. And something that Mom had always sung to us when we were little was, it was like, I love you, a bushel and a peck, that a bushel and a peck and a hug around the neck song. And so Michelle had put, she put that in, she put that in my wallet one time as a surprise for me to find. And I've been carrying that with me for all that time, for everywhere that I went. And then I wanted her to have that.
So what did you do with it?
There's a place that you could put that, a personal thing, in her, in the casket, and I put that in her hand so that it could be put in the special place so that wherever she went.
Did you say goodbye to Rylan? How did you do that?
All I could do was just put my hand on her stomach.
Jason's attorney asked him if he could continue, and he said yes. He was then asked why he purchased new shoes on November 7th, 2006, and he said his house hadn't yet been released and that the police had taken his luggage and, quote, took everything. As for the internet searches that were found on his computer for search terms, anatomy of a knockout and head trauma, Jason explained those as well. He said in the beginning of the summer, he came upon a car accident that had just occurred. He said he pulled over to the side of the road to help. The victim had been knocked out, and it looked like he had a traumatic head injury. He tried to administer first aid, but all he could do was take the man's vitals until emergency personnel arrived. He said later, he wanted to know if there was anything else he could have done in that situation.
All right, so when you went into the Yahoo site and typed in anatomy of a knockout, what sorts of searches came back?
Well, I think I looked up, I was looking up knockout and head trauma, and it was all sports related, like boxing, mixed martial arts and stuff like that. Not at all what I was trying to find out Okay. And
so what did you do to try to get more information?
Well, since I kept getting the sports type stuff, I tried to use more of a medical terminology. So I tried anatomy, and that I didn't get anything. So then I went to a medical website, went to WebMD, and I think put in head trauma, and I never got any information that would have assisted me, I think, any better in the situation that I came upon. And I don't know if he was able to hear me at all, or if he lived or if he died.
After Michelle's murder, he said he soon lost his job due to the media and due to some of the internet vigilante groups calling his work. He said he didn't have the money for a full-blown custody battle. As a result of Michelle's death, he told the court that he lost everything: family, friends, and jobs. On cross-examination, Assistant District Attorney Holt brought up an incident where Jason punched his then-fiancée, Genevieve Cargill's windshield, and broke it. He said he did do that, but claimed that he never hit her. Holt also asked about another incident where Genevieve found a letter to Jason from another woman, and Jason became so angry that he punched a wall in the hole of his apartment. Jason said he remembers Genevieve reading the letter, but said that he never punched a wall. Holt then brought up Jason's infidelity and asked if he still loved his wife during all the instances he cheated on her. He said yes. She then moved on to the custody of Cassidy and Jason's testimony that he couldn't afford to fight a custody battle.
And as part of that legal procedure, you would be required to sit for a deposition to answer questions. Isn't that right?
Yes, ma'am. From what I understand.
Okay. Well, your attorney told you that.
Yes, ma'am.
And you may be required to answer written questions, and both of those would be under oath. Is that right?
I don't remember ever talking about written questions, but I remember them saying about a deposition, understanding what a deposition was.
Okay, and what was your understanding about what a deposition was?
It was exactly like you just described.
Okay. Putting your hand on the Bible, swearing to tell the truth, and answering the questions that were posed to you?
Yes, ma'am.
But instead of doing that, you signed over custody of your child, is that right?
Yes, ma'am. I did sign over custody of my child.
Holt asked him why he never spoke with the police. Jason said he wanted to wait until he got an attorney.
So let's talk about that. You said that you went and got an attorney. What did you tell your attorney?
I told the attorney what I'm telling the people here today. I told the attorney about my experience riding up to the house and when the car being seized. I told the attorney about where I was, that I was away on a business trip. I told my attorney that I was alone and by myself. I told my attorney that my wife was pregnant. I told my attorney that I was having an affair. I told my attorney a lot. And my attorney said, I don't think you should talk to the law enforcement.
So basically, after you laid out those facts and what you've told to the jury, the lawyer told you don't talk to the police?
Yes, ma'am.
So now over 4 years later, you sit here and today decide to tell this jury where you were and what you were doing on the night of your wife's murder?
Yes, ma'am.
And in the days, weeks, hours, years that have transpired, you have never told that story to anyone else, have you?
No, ma'am. I've told that story to my attorneys here. So the past 18 and a half months, as I've been arrested, my attorneys have known that.
So you continue to follow that advice, that is to keep your mouth shut, to not say anything, even after you were arrested?
Yes, ma'am.
You never, yourself, or anyone acting on your behalf, contacted the investigating agency to find out about the investigation into your wife's murder, did you?
I did not. I can't speak for anyone in my family.
Okay. Well, did you ask anyone to contact and find out the details of the investigation and what was going on?
No, ma'am. I didn't talk about anything to anyone.
Well, I'm asking, did you ask anybody? to make those phone calls?
I didn't talk about anything, so no, ma'am. That would be talking about it.
On redirect, Jason's attorney asked him about Pankof PD, the medicine that was found in Cassidy's room. Jason told the court that it's a cough and cold product for kids and that it was grape-flavored. He said they used to sell it to pediatricians. The jury deliberated for days before returning to the courtroom to tell the court that they were deadlocked. They could not agree on a verdict, and so Judge Stevens ordered a mistrial. The state decided to retry Jason, but this time, while he awaited his new trial, he was let out on bail. In February 2012, the state again presented their case, this time to a different jury. And this time, they had a few new things to introduce to this jury. Michelle's sister Meredith testified again for the prosecution. She relayed pretty much everything she did in the first trial, but something else came up on redirect that she hadn't testified to before and wasn't asked about in the first trial.
In the part of the 911 call that Mr. Collins has just asked you about, my niece is very smart for her age. Mm-hmm. She's 2.5. But I think that she's saying that there was somebody in the house. I don't really understand because I know that she doesn't understand. What was going on that led you to say that?
Earlier in the phone call, she had referenced her father. And then when I asked her further questions, she was saying he.
Were you able to, at that time, talk to Cassidy and did you try to talk to Cassidy after this phone call to find out what had happened and what she had seen? Did you try? There on that day?
There on that day when we were in the fire truck, she continued to talk about her father. And later, when we got back to my house, a child psychologist was there, but she had just kind of shut down.
It was the first time either jury would have heard that Cassidy had mentioned her father. The state also presented a new witness, Kimball Sargent, a licensed therapist who testified that just 1 week prior to her death, Michelle came to see her and cried throughout their whole session. She said Michelle was stressed out about the fact that she was pregnant and that her marriage was in trouble. She said sex was a major issue in their marriage.
She felt somewhat inadequate, and see that there was a problem in that she had been sexually assaulted when she was in college. Okay. And so she had had sex forced on her. And one of the issues she was having with Jason at that time was that when she had sex with him, she felt like he was forcing himself on her.
Okay. So as far as the intimacy, she described there was no romance or no love involved. Is that what she's describing?
Yes.
Okay.
That she, the way that he approached her for sex, she had the same sort of feelings about that as she did when she had been assaulted. And she said when she was with other boyfriends and had other relationships, it had not been that way.
Okay. But it was that way with her husband?
Yes, sir.
Who she had one child with and was pregnant by him again?
Yes, sir.
Another new witness was Jennifer Powell, a friend of Michelle's, who testified that when Michelle was pregnant with Cassidy, Jason had wanted her to get an abortion, but then a week or two later, they were engaged. Also new to the second trial was evidence about Cassidy's behavior after her mother's death, including Ashley Palmateer, a daycare teacher from Country Sunshine Children's Center Daycare, who testified about Cassidy's behavior once she returned to the center the following Monday after her mother's death. She said Cassidy was very withdrawn. She usually played with other kids, but she seemed to just want to play by herself. On the Thursday after Michelle's murder, she noticed Cassidy doing something unusual as the kids were all outside playing on the playground. She had set up a dollhouse with two dolls inside.
I noticed her playing with two dolls and a chair and the dollhouse, and she was striking one doll with the other doll and the chair, and she told me mommy has boo-boos all over.
Had you ever heard her prior to that time use the term boo-boo?
Yes, I had.
Okay, and under what circumstances?
She would usually refer to any kind of injury that involved blood, a boo-boo.
Okay. Okay, so after she made that statement to you, what did you see her do, or what did she say, or did you respond to that?
I didn't say anything to her. I continued to watch her hit the one doll with the other. And I tapped my coworker, Brooke, on her shoulder so she could see as well.
Okay.
And then I witnessed her place the one doll on the bed face down.
Okay. When you say the one doll?
The doll with the brown hair and the ponytail.
Did she ever refer to that doll in any way, in general name or anything, or refer to it anyway?
Yes, she referred to it as the mommy doll.
And what did she refer to it in that way prior to that day, or?
Not that I recall.
The prosecution brought in the dollhouse and dolls, and Ashley got up to demonstrate exactly what she saw Cassidy doing.
So the dollhouse was completely open. Cassidy would have been right here, and I was sort of angled behind her so I could see her and still see everyone else. And the dollhouse was up, or the bed was up on top.
Okay. And using those dolls and the chair, can you demonstrate what you saw her do?
She had the one doll with the short gray hair in one hand, along with the chair. And then she had what she referred to as the mommy doll in the other hand, and she began hitting the doll repeatedly.
On what part of that doll was she hitting it?
I do not recall.
Okay.
And then she laid the mommy doll face down onto the bed.
And during that time, you were asking her what she was doing, and she made some statement. During the time of what you've just described, when was that? The statement or statements made by her?
While she was hitting the doll, she said, mommy's getting a spanking for biting. And then when she laid the doll down is when she said, mommy has boo-boos all over, mommy has red stuff all over.
She said Cassidy never identified who the other doll was. The one she referred to as the mommy doll had brown hair and a ponytail. And the other doll was a tall woman with short gray hair wearing a tracksuit. Ashley said there were about 10 dolls available for her to play with, but only 3 of them were human-like. The others were more cartoonish, with no arms or legs. Additional shoe evidence also came in at this trial, like testimony from Tom Rhea, the global director of men's product development at Hush Puppies, who testified that there were only 195 pairs of brown Orbitals, size 12 shoes, ever made anywhere in the world. The prosecution also now had Jason's side of the story, whereas in the first trial, they had no idea what he was going to say until he got up on the stand. They played his testimony from the first trial for the jury, and then they called Sergeant Richard Spivey, the lead investigator, to the stand, to talk about it. Here are some of the things from Jason's testimony that Sergeant Spivey said were inconsistent with the evidence. In Jason's testimony, he stated that while he was at the Hampton Inn, after he had checked into his room, he went outside to get his phone charger and then again to smoke a cigar. Sergeant Spivey told the jury that the weather there the night of November 2nd may not have been the ideal cigar smoking weather. There were wind gusts up to 30 miles per hour, and it was just about 30 degrees outside. When reviewing the clothing that was obtained from Jason's luggage, he said he never found any substantial outerwear, just a suit jacket. Sergeant Spivey said he looked at all the surveillance video from the camera in the lobby at the Hampton Inn from 6:30 in the morning on November 3rd. Jason had testified that he had eaten breakfast in the lobby, but while many other guests were seen on the surveillance camera getting food, Jason was not. In the picture from Cassidy's third birthday party, Jason testified that he wore a black sweater with a white stripe across the chest. The prosecution brought out blown-up photos of that one and of the image from the surveillance video at the Hampton Inn. Sergeant Spivey said there were definite differences in the shirts and pointed them out to the jury. The collars, the stripes, and the actual colors of the shirts were different, he said. When he had been asked about why he turned over custody of Cassidy to Meredith, Jason had testified that he had to do it because he couldn't financially fight that battle. Sergeant Spivey testified that Jason had $20,000 in his IRA account and that he had a total of about $60,000 in cash available to him as well. On cross-examination, Jason's attorney, Mike Klinkesem, brought up the cameras at the Hampton Inn. Sergeant Spivey said the camera that had been unplugged was plugged back in at 5:30 a.m. and that the Hampton Inn employee had kicked the rock out from the door. There were no surveillance images of Jason returning to the hotel in the morning, and no one could get back inside from that door after the rock had been kicked out. There was also no witness testimony that placed Jason returning to the hotel in the early morning hours. And the overnight clerk at the Hampton Inn distributed checkout receipts and copies of USA Today to the rooms between 3 and 5 a.m. or later. And both the receipt as well as the USA Today were found in Jason's Ford Explorer by police. Klinkesem also brought up Gracie Dom's testimony, the cashier from the Four Brothers convenience store, who said she saw Jason around 5:30 the morning of Friday, November 3rd. Sergeant Spivey told the jury that he had interviewed Gracie Dom six different times, yet never found out who the regular customer was, who she said was in the gas station at the same time as Jason. They had even set up surveillance cameras at the station for 60 days, but to no avail. Sergeant Spivey also told the jury that on the eBay printouts, as well as on the medicine cup in Cassidy's room, there were unidentified fingerprints that didn't belong to Jason or Michelle. There was one other thing the jury in this trial heard that the jury in the first trial did not, and that was the fact that Jason had been declared Michelle's slayer after not responding to the wrongful death lawsuit filed against him by the Fishers. Some of the new evidence the defense presented in their case included another neighbor of Jason's and Michelle's, who testified that she was leaving her house at about 6:15 in the morning on November 3rd, when she saw a blue or gray SUV that looked like it was going to pull out in front of her. But on cross-examination, she admitted that she couldn't remember what address the car had been pulling out of. When Jason's mom, Pat Young, was called to the stand, she told the jury that when they cleaned out Jason and Michelle's home after her murder, she found a cigar humidifier. The defense also called Steve Hale, a private investigator, to the stand. Steve tested the door of Jason's room at the Hampton Inn and concluded that the door didn't fully close when you would let it go, meaning that an electronic key card wasn't needed since it didn't latch. Steve also testified that the emergency exit door could be kept open using a twig, as Jason had testified he used when going out to smoke his cigar. This time around, Jason did not take the stand. The jury of eight women and four men deliberated for about 6 hours before returning a guilty verdict of first-degree murder. At sentencing, Judge Stevens made the following remarks. If on November 2, 2006, Michelle Young had called the police and had reported that her husband had beaten her, and if police had responded and found her with missing teeth and a broken nose and black eyes, no one that this couple knew, including their closest friends, would have been surprised. So why would anyone be surprised when Michelle Young was found beaten to death? The pattern is the same. Jason was sentenced to life in prison without parole. But Jason's team wasn't about to give up. In their appeal, they argued that Judge Stevens erred by allowing testimony about his wrongful death lawsuit, Cassidy's custody complaint, and testimony from the daycare workers about Cassidy's behavior after the murder. They also took issue with an instruction Judge Stevens gave to the jury, in which he said that they could consider Jason's failure to talk to friends and family as evidence of guilt. And just 2 years after his conviction, in 2014, the North Carolina Court of Appeals agreed and ordered a third trial for Jason, saying in part that the testimony about the wrongful death lawsuit and child custody complaint never should have been allowed in at a second trial. They said that it severely impacted Jason's ability to receive a fair trial. Prosecutors appealed the ruling, however, to the North Carolina Supreme Court, which halted the new trial. They focused on the procedural side of the appeal, saying that the Court of Appeals had erred in ordering a new trial, and that Jason's attorneys were the ones who had failed to object to the civil proceedings testimony being entered at trial. And so the Court of Appeals then ruled that a hearing be ordered so that Jason could argue for a new trial based on ineffective assistance of counsel. In August 2017, after hearing their arguments, Wake Superior Court Judge Paul Ridgway denied Jason's request for a new trial. Ridgway wrote that there was, quote, strong circumstantial evidence that Jason was guilty, along with, quote, the impeachment of his alibi and evidence of Jason's conduct after the murder. He wrote, quote, because defendant testified at the first trial and not at the second, the state was able to develop compelling evidence that the defendant's first public statement, made 1,693 days after the murder, was one of a guilty man who murdered his wife, rather than a man who loved his wife. And that's all for today's episode. Let me know what you think about this case. Do you think Jason is guilty of murdering Michelle? Would you have been able to convict at either his first or second trial if you had been on the jury? You can join my discussion group on Facebook at courtjunkie.com/Facebook. Let me know on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And as a reminder, if you want to hear these Court Junkie episodes early and ad-free, all you have to do is go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will then send you to my Patreon page. There, you can sign up, it's super easy, and donate as little as $1 a month. You'll then get access to an exclusive feed that you can add to any podcast listening app. And on that feed will be early ad-free episodes of Court Junkie. I want to thank all of today's sponsors and give a special thank you to Everlywell. Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible, but now it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of physician-reviewed private tests, from food sensitivity to metabolism to thyroid. No more sitting in waiting rooms or waiting on your results. Head on over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Everlywell, your test on your time and on your terms. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.